Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast with Lindsay Rountree making loud noises in the background already.
Sorry about that.
I'd like to welcome our special guest for this podcast session, James Shepherd, Managing Partner for Growth at M&C Saatchi Performance. Welcome, James.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pretty bit of a mouthful of a job title.
Yes. Yes. But as I said to you off mic, it's less of a mouthful than
what it actually means.
For new business marketing and some clients. So.
This is certainly an improvement on that.
Yeah. Ah, the catch-all job title.
Yes. Indeed. Yeah. And welcome to our catch-all job title, Head of Content, Lindsay Rountree. How are you doing over there, Lindsay?
That's a very good point, actually. Yeah, I'm very well. How are you, Rachel?
I'm very good, thank you. Delighted to be back on the Mad Tech Podcast.
Yeah.
You and Kieran have been nudging me out of the way the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Outrageous. Yeah. It's good to have you back. Thank you.
Yeah.
Kieran's
quite frankly,
isn't he?
Very difficult.
Can I ask what isn't content on Exchange?
Well, I was going to say, Lindsay's job title kind of means does everything except a small amount of stuff that the sales team crack on with.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, so let's start having a chat about this week's news stories. The first news story I wanted to chat about was news that wasn't actually sort of really well publicised, but we think is a really interesting and potentially big piece of news, and that's that Nike have confirmed that they're in conversations to acquire TraceMe, which was effectively when it started a fan engagement app, a sort of a way of enabling fans to engage with sports stars and potentially other celebrities, and then kind of later pivoted or morphed into something called Tally, which was a wider engagement platform between sports teams, fans and sporting venues, so much more of an engagement play. Now, the reason that we think this is interesting is because, you know, in the statement that sort of came out in this news piece, which we found on TechCrunch, Nike actually sort of were prominent about saying this is a supplement to Nike's already existing content strategy and content platforms. So the reason we think this is really interesting is we've been talking about this a lot at Exchange Wire over the last couple of weeks, which is that we can see a world where brands are sort of morphing into potentially media owners, content providers, setting up and facilitating content platforms and using that as a way to enhance that direct consumer relationship. So we think this is fascinating for that reason. So that's why I wanted to discuss it with you two this morning. Interested in your thoughts on what Nike's going to do with this and also whether it underscores the critical importance of first-party data for brands. Also another thing that we're talking about a lot in the industry lately. As we know, reliance on third-party cookie targeting sort of is disappearing in the industry. It seems to be pushing both ends of the industry, whether that's publishers or whether that's brands and marketers, into a world where they really need to have that kind of opted-in data layer. So, James, your sort of perspective first on this particular story?
So it's interesting. I think, you know, going back to the early part of this decade and working in agencies, I remember sort of heads of content sort of suddenly appearing and brands taking a really vested interest about how they could sort of own the customer a little bit more than they used to.
Mm.
I think Nike definitely has an easier route into that because sport in terms of content is very sticky and Nike in terms of sport are obviously very well aligned with that. It's really interesting to see how these things play out. The sort of, I don't know whether it's the cynical part of me, but I always think about this is just owning customer data more.
Yeah.
You know, we need to know more about our customers. You know, and I know Nike are obviously investing quite a lot in their D2C product as well, which is going to be incredibly important for them. But brands like that need to know more about their customers than they have historically done.
Yeah.
Their customers spend the majority of their time online and they don't spend the majority of their time online at Nike.com or any of their app products, of which there are numerous. They spend the majority of their time on social platforms, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Snapchat.
Yeah.
And those are walled gardens. So, you know, brands are all desperately trying to find a way that they can get a piece of that action because you can't take the data out of Facebook, you can't take the data out of Google. So they don't know a lot about their customers. Therefore, they create these platforms in order to know more about them. I think the big challenge that all brands have with this, and, you know, it's, as I said, with Nike's affiliation with sport, it's probably less of a challenge for them. But how do you pull consumers out of these platforms where the consumer is in control?
Yeah.
you know, as a consumer, I can choose and curate my social profile. I can choose and curate what brands I engage with and the news I'm interested in. And it's much more of a pull experience for consumers. I think the battle for brands will be, how do we get consumers into our environment so we can sort of get to own their data a little bit more and own that customer journey a little bit more.
Yeah, you're quite right. That's what's interesting about this, isn't it? It feels like perhaps it's a pitch to acquire an environment where they see fans and own that. But the question is that what will happen going forward? You know, will they be able to sustain that? Because, and I think the article also mentioned, maybe it is, you know, an opportunity to acquire that customer data, but actually if they're to turn it into a real asset, then they need to really convert it into an engagement platform. It needs to be something where they can actually interact with their customers in more of an ongoing fashion. Lindsay, what's your point of view on this?
Yeah, I mean,
Being a big trainer fan, obviously.
Well, you know,
I prefer Adidas over your Nikes,
double. I'm probably equal, maybe more Adidas than Nike.
Okay. I saw a brand new box of Nikes just out there on the desk.
Yeah, and that's not either of ours.
No, okay. No, we are trainer fans, but yes, that belongs
often
to our commercial director.
Arriving in this office, actually, as it goes. But yeah, I completely agree with what you just said. I think that if they, in acquiring TraceMe, they need to do more than just acquire it. They need to make sure they make it work for their business. And what does that mean for their business? Are they becoming a brand that's basically acquiring a bunch of first party data and going, okay, brilliant, we've got that. Now we can understand our customers better. How will they then use TraceMe and everything that's within TraceMe? There's another kind of product in there called Tally as well.
Yeah.
To actually further engage with their customers, further engage with potential customers, and use it kind of as a customer lifetime value type of exercise, and keep engaging with a wider audience and almost become some kind of publisher that engages with. We talked last week, we're talking a lot about brands buying publishers or brands becoming publishers. And James, you were talking about, you know, the heads of content that a lot of these brands are hiring. You're seeing it actually everywhere. Like a lot of these big brands are now employing heads of content because they realize that that is how they make their consumers sticky.
Yeah.
The consumers will come to them to find out more about this stuff, not just there to purchase. So it's all about the kind of looking at the consumer journey and not just about how I purchase. And brands like Nike that for so long have just been manufacturers and just worked with retailers and not had any insight into kind of who their customer is, now have this opportunity to really create something. And they're already starting on that path by trying to make consumers come to them directly rather than go to retailers they would typically go to.
Or buy via other online marketplaces.
Yeah, but is the consumer going to them as a first port of call? Or are they still going to that retailer first and then coming to Nike going, actually, I wonder if Nike have got a discount on, like, and looking to get it for them directly?
Yeah,
how does Nike make Nike the first port of call? I think that's where things like TraceMe will be very interesting for them.
Yeah.
But from a sample group of three, I mean, how do you buy trainers? I still go into the high street and buy trainers, but then Nike, what was it, 2017 is now available on Amazon. Their D2C business, I think they're investing
better
in
more than
any other part of the business.
They are.
I think that's shown really strong growth after the last 12 months.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see where, you know, because they're now available on Amazon and because that is the primary destination for shopping full stop for consumers, it'll be interesting to see how this plays into their own D2C proposition.
Definitely.
Well, exactly.
I mean, I've started certainly going to these companies direct more and more than I ever used to.
Me too.
But I also use them as they are one of a list of maybe five or six places that I will go to. And it's all down to price.
Mm.
And often the likes of Nike and Adidas, my two favourites, do have really good discounts on. So you do end up buying there. But that's sustainable for a short period of time. That's short-termism. Yeah. What's
exactly
their long-term strategy?
And that's what's interesting about this, right, is that they must be looking at those customer journeys. I'd be really fascinated to know what the kind of stats look like in terms of, you know, how whether sales have increased on their own platform direct, you know, how much those promotions really make a difference. Because like you, Lindsay, I probably get, you know, Adidas emails and I'm on their mail shot list. If they come up with a sale or something on discounts, then I'm going straight to Adidas. I'm not going to any other marketplace because I want to buy direct from them. So has that impacted their sales in the long term? But also, how do they then follow us around? Because I'm only going to do that just once or maybe twice when I want to actually purchase something explicitly from them. So that's what will be really interesting is how will they use this platform to try to draw all of that together?
And I will say, like TraceMe and Tally, you know, they're buying this for, if they are buying this for first party data, the likes of us will not be TraceMe customers.
No, so that's what's interesting.
So they're buying a limited pool of data. How do they expand that out to beyond to people that are just sports enthusiasts that actually are huge fashion enthusiasts instead?
Exactly.
And that's the other bit they're probably missing in this.
And that's why I'm interested in your point of view on this, James. So you're talking about how they're great at building brand, and they are. So you could argue, to a certain extent, from a content perspective, they've kind of got that fashion brand image, and they've no doubt got an army of people working for them that are experts in that. How do they bring that together with this notion of going somewhere for customer engagement that is more than just a one-time purchase? Mm. How are they going to bring all of that together? Where would you start?
I mean, that's the day to play, isn't it? I mean, you look at these platforms, and are these platforms that are going to be sort of brought into the sort of Nike umbrella, and are they going to be Nike-led platforms, or are they going to remember separate as TraceMe and Tally platforms? And therefore, is it just the data play? We want to understand, because there's a big draw with those platforms. They have license with a lot of American sports. I mean, obviously it's American-centric at the moment, the scope's obviously there to broaden that to other sports around the world. But that's a big draw in itself. So is that the data play? Is it just understanding more about people who like sports, who are therefore people who are likely to buy Nike, and therefore we can market to those people more effectively on our own channels? Or does it all come under one big Nike-owned content umbrella? It gets rebranded. It's part of the Nike family. It's a big content play. We, explicitly want to own more of your time online, driven by our content.
Mm. It's just going to be fascinating to watch how this plays out. And I think this is just the first in, a potential lengthy list of big brands looking to do this. So I'm really, really interested to see how it's going to play out. And a theoretical question for both of you. Could you see the reverse happening? So could you see sort of content owners, media owners, publishers, content creators buying brands?
They're broke. No.
That's the first thing I thought too. But no. I don't know. Smaller,
well,
cheaper
News Corp.
Brand?
News Corp could do maybe.
Yeah, and a big publisher. Yeah.
But something, Nike is what's worth something like 117 billion or something.
I'm
so
not
maybe
thinking,
not Nike.
No, I'm not thinking anyone's going to buy Nike. But what about some of the, what's to say that a content provider or a content owner couldn't look to acquire what is a kind of growing challenger brand at a cheaper point in their trajectory?
I mean, there are publishers. We are seeing publishers, content providers, media owners, whatever we're calling them in this context, move into a kind of a service layer, move into a Condé Nast is a great example of a company that is branching out beyond just providing content, but actually providing a way to be able to book a holiday when looking at travel and that kind of thing. And we are seeing companies start doing that. BuzzFeed is these new next generation publishers. BuzzFeed, a great example, doing a lot of tie-ins with different types of brands and different other different publishers and different e-commerce platforms, but also producing their own products like the BuzzFeed, the Tasty product. So potentially, but they'd need a lot to make it work because it's very, very different from what they're used to.
For sure.
I can see the appeal of, struggling traditional content provider wanting to buy or get involved with, emerging
products.
Disruptor brand.
Yeah.
But from the other side of the fence, if you're emerging disruptor brand and you're in high demand and you've got VCs knocking down your door, that's the money you're going to take.
Yeah, yeah. It's
you're,
true.
You're not going to take the money of traditional publishing behemoth.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but I guess there's a part of me that thinks maybe there's some content providers out there that have rich pools of data that enable them to think, well, actually, I'm learning a lot about these customers of ours, these readers, and I can imagine what we could target them with in terms of products. So maybe it's more about them potentially developing products themselves.
Yeah, they might then build rather than buy.
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know. These are the sorts of highbrow things we chat about at Exchange Wire Towers Day on Day, James. What's the future going to look like? Big on predictions.
I liked your punchy response. I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking. I probably No.
It's fine to say no. Yeah. Okay, moving on to the second story, which is about the IAB's release of the annual digital ad spend report. We've seen an early snippet of the report and some figures associated with that, which shows us that digital ad spend is up overall 17% year on year, and display video is the key contributor to this, which is perhaps no surprise, but that's up a whopping 37% year on year, which is huge. And it's also showing us that there's a big uplift in search as well, 13% uplift year on year from last year. So I'm interested in your early thoughts on these stats. What does this say about the health of the digital digital advertising industry in general. And what is it telling us about the world of digital video? James?
So, I mean, the headline from that, as somebody who's here to represent a digital media agency, is good news. I think, you know, it's, you know, this is a trend that's obviously been going on for a long time. I think, I don't know if you've checked the news in the last hour, and this is going out sort of, we're recording this at Wednesday at 11, like there's a deal in place
Thursday, there's a deal in place, but not agreed. Brexit we're talking about now,
so,
aren't we?
Yeah, and let's not get into that. But, no. You know, there's a lot of economic uncertainty going on around at the moment. God knows what's going to happen in the next few weeks. I think that there's still confidence from the market in digital is really, really encouraging. So that's very pleasing. I think these things are always really intriguing because, you know, Is digital budget incremental? Is it cannibalizing budget from elsewhere? Why? You know, where's it coming from? TV continues to, it depends who you listen to, either plateau or drop off, certainly. You know, the increased investment in digital video would suggest film still works. It just works in shorter, smaller format. So that's good to see. I think what's really interesting on a sort of bigger picture, and we don't know now, and we won't know for some time, is, you know, how the move of sort of film to smaller format and shorter format will affect brand building long term. Because, you know, we're all used to growing up when, you know, brands were built on TV, and I don't necessarily think they are anymore. So it'd be interesting to see longer term how digital video, VOD, VOL, pre-roll, that sort of thing, has an effect on brand building.
Yeah. And I'm sure that will, that will sort of go hand in hand with the quality of advertising that we're seeing in that format, which has still got quite a way to go. Yes. Big eyebrow raise from James over there in the corner.
I work for a performance agency. You know, we buy digital media ROI positive for our clients. You know, we measure towards KPIs that affect business change, and that's key. That's how we operate. You know, we don't measure towards things like reach and impressions and viewability, or if, you know, 10% of your ad was in view for 0.5 of a second, we don't think it really makes much of a difference. My suspicion is that the majority of ad spend on digital still goes that way. And that's something we're obviously trying hard to change.
Yep. Yep. Lindsay, your point of view?
I mean, I guess basically agree with everything James just said there. I mean, so we had New Video Frontiers was a big TV and video event yesterday. Mm. I moderated a panel that had ISBA, Direct Line and ITV on it. And, you know, Direct Line starts, they're a big performance brand that also do a lot of brand advertising as well. And kind of the importance of TV for them is has always been very significant. And they have built their kind of brand on linear TV, and they're trying to work out how to navigate this sort of new world of digital OTT versus linear TV, mm-hmm. and saying, well, why would I go for addressability when I can go for addressability plus the other 3 million people that I necessarily didn't want to reach but can build a brand out of it? So there's still a lot of advertisers that I feel like are wrestling with that and not really understanding how to push it. And then we haven't got the taxonomy from the IAB Aspen report as to kind of what they're classing as video.
Yeah.
Because again, that's not really clear anymore, because, you know, if you're buying YouTube, is that being watched on a, is that being cast to a screen? Is it being watched on a phone? How is it being viewed on a laptop? You could argue that if it's being cast to a TV, that's now actually OTT.
Yep.
It's not normal video, but the way you're buying it is still identical. You're still, yep, having to buy YouTube, but actually how it's being viewed, interacted with, engaged with is completely, utterly different.
Yep.
So that then, you know, talking about ad formats and looking at bumpers and versus building a brand on a TV, I think that's massively changed. And I think that there's still a lot of misunderstanding going on with that in general. But you mentioned kind of you buy on business outcomes, mm-hmm. basically, and that is the important thing. And it does worry me there are still businesses out there that don't, and they say they can't because they can't measure, but that's not really an excuse. Like, that you have a bottom line in your business.
Yeah.
What is it you're trying to achieve as a business? Make your media work for that, surely. Yeah.
And you can measure everything, even, yeah, upper funnel activity. It's, yeah, just what you choose to measure.
Exactly, and what you choose to deem as important.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we create things for clients on upper funnel metrics like HQEs or high quality engagements, where we, you know, measure the effectiveness of ads by completions or percentage completions or shares or anything like that. And these are all proxies that we can use to signify how engaged people have been with adverts, and then also use that data to sort of, you know, migrate people throughout the funnel. And I think that's the possibly the disconnect that exists in broad strokes in digital today, is that sort of there's a lot of activity that's perhaps previously lived on traditional channels that's now just thrown out to digital, and it's not really been adapted in terms of how we measure the efficacy of it.
And I mean, also that point about sort of TV advertising versus digital, and whether and what we're actually seeing here, what the breakdown of that digital growth looks like. What's your view on room to move? You know, it feels like it's actually just the start for video advertising, using air quotes here. And of course, like you said yesterday, like you said, Lindsay, referencing NVF yesterday, there was plenty of discussion about TV viewing habits and how they're changing and not changing. You know, someone will have you believe that they're completely revolutionising, and others will have you believe that according to the stats they're actually not changing that much.
And we aren't ready yet for it.
Exactly.
Polls apart,
I really struggle to believe that. But again, sample group of one. I mean, you mentioned Direct Line earlier. I remember a red telephone jumping over a little bump in the road or something from a TV advert 20 years ago. I couldn't tell you what they do now.
No, well, because, and is that because...
But they still invest heavily in linear TV.
But they still invest heavily in TV, as you say. But
they believe they build a brand from it.
Through that. But and you're saying that, James, because you're not watching so much TV, so you're not seeing those ads, or what?
I don't watch linear... I watch sport on linear TV.
Yeah.
And I mean, like most people, I'm a Bake Off fan.
Of course. Who isn't a Bake Off fan?
Watched this week's episode last night, and I've got two options: 4OD with pre-roll, or catch up, where I can skip through the ads, because I've got a series link. Catch up's my option, skipping through the ads,
and
I think that's the majority of behaviour. But then, is it a generational thing? Am I like this because I'm slightly younger, and you know, I work in a technology space, and you know, am I more FA? Are the majority of people still watching linear TV?
We've had this argument a lot in the office recently, because I am of an opinion, a fairly strong opinion. I will hold myself up to these opinions, that we are talking about, when we talk about these conversations, we're normally having this conversation as people that work in the industry, as people that live in London, and the rest of the UK is not London, to the point where you would never run a test campaign in London to work out what's going to happen nationally, because they're completely different entities. And actually, there's still vast swathes of the UK that don't even have strong enough broadband to be able to stream something. If I think about where my dad lives, like, the Wi-Fi there is atrocious. It'll take about 4.5 hours to download something. Oh, barely. It's awful. And if you want to download something from Sky, it will take probably an hour to download something, whereas I've got fiber optic and it takes me about 2 minutes. It's completely different. I mean, when we had fiber optic in London, some people in the UK didn't even have broadband. They were still using dial-up, so that's how slow some of these areas are. So there isn't an opportunity to do these things, and actually many people do still have Freeview boxes and do still watch terrestrial TV, and I know many people that will sit there on Saturday night and still watch all the shows normally on TV.
That are programmed through terrestrial linear TV.
That might not be what I do. And yes, there's definitely a generational thing to that as well. But I think there's also a location thing has to be come into play when we have this conversation about TV viewing habits, because many will have you believe linear is dead. Based on the rest of the country outside London, I don't believe it is at all.
I'd agree with that. It's a regional thing or a geographic thing, but it's also very much a demographic thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, but also key to that demographic sort of point, though, has got to be what younger generations are doing. And I think that is a really important conversation too. Okay, linear might be still highly viewed and heavily relied upon in regions where internet connectivity isn't great, but there's a whole generation of young people that probably don't even know what don't know what a telly is.
Yeah.
You know, they are only used to watching stuff through their own handheld devices or maybe laptops or, And then there's a generation of young people that do know what a telly is, but went to uni young enough that they just relied on their laptop and their handheld devices for any consumption of screen content. And
I did have a conversation with younger people in the office talking about the little TVs you have at university that had the built-in video things. And somebody in the 20s went, "What the hell are you talking about? What do you mean, what we're talking about? What did you watch TV on?" He's like, "I'm doing my laptop."
So that video.
And that was just alien to us older people going, "Oh, I see, of course, your laptop."
Yeah.
Didn't have the little TV video combis that I loved so much.
Quite frightening rapid rate of change, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think will sort of push the TV viewing community to a world beyond linear. It's when those young people are our age, you know, they will have had a lifetime of not relying on tellies. And so that's where I think things will change. Of course, that's another sort of 10, 15 years down the track.
And that's the point I made at the beginning, is we just don't know at the moment. No. When I think about brand building, and the reason I wanted to work in this industry when I was younger is because I liked adverts.
Yeah.
And they were more of an event. And there's ad campaigns I can recall and songs and things that go with them, and slogans and phrases from 20, 30 years ago. But I don't think in 20, 30 years ago, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds watching content on Netflix or wherever they're consuming content.
You've got no idea what kids are watching, have you?
I've got no idea what kids are watching.
Content. Stuff.
Watching stuff.
Excellent technical explanation, James.
But thank you. but the point is, they're not watching adverts like we used to watch adverts.
No, you're right. Yeah.
And that's a challenge for brand building.
Yeah,
for sure. But then the behemoths today don't do, Airbnb, Uber, they became on such a ubiquitous scale without ever running any brand building exercise. And now they do.
Yeah.
Now they're running, large-scale TVC.
I think you could argue there's still an incredible amount of power in a really good ad. So, ads that win awards, ads that get shown during the bloody Super Bowl in the US or whatever, some of those are as entertaining as a program could be. Mm. So if the investment is put into those sorts of ad formats, you could see how people could still get drawn into that.
Yes.
It's just that that's not where the creation of ad in a digital environment, those ads aren't necessarily being created in quite the same way. And so they're also not being delivered in the same way. So that's why people aren't watching them.
And they are much more sort of event-based and driven by so much hype. I mean, you think about the
Christmas ads.
Fuss every year around the John Lewis ad. I mean, it's ridiculous. And they start seeding that weeks out.
Yeah.
But they are very much event driven. I just think on a day to day basis, it's not getting the cut through that it used to.
No, not at all. And that in itself is becoming a big issue.
Yeah. And if you look at longer term trends, I was looking at some stuff yesterday around, 2018 to 2021, and there's going to be predicted big drop-offs in TV, big drop-offs in print, but out of home's relatively static because our engagement with that's not changing.
No, you're
still
right.
Out there, we're still walking about.
Yep.
Digital out of home is increasingly being able to be bought programmatically, so we can be much more measurable and effective with how we buy it.
I'll move us on to the next story in a second because we've paused on this for quite a while, but it's a really interesting conversation. But that was one of the things I was going to ask, is where are we going to start to see innovation then in terms of digital ad spend growth? And, in general, when we're chatting about this in terms of the industry as a whole at Exchange, why we're often talking about other channels like out of home, audio, and out of home seems to me to be an area where we could really start seeing quite engaging, creative formats that help to build brand.
Unsurprisingly, we think performance marketing is the future.
Yeah.
That's shocking.
Yes, shocking. if you can buy it, measure it, optimize it, track it, then we're interested. When programmatic TV is available to buy at such a scale, we'll do so. Programmatic out of home, we'll do so. Mm-hmm. Everything moving towards digital, even, the more, air quotes again, traditional channels, when they can be bought and measured effectively, they will be.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Right, third story I wanted to chat with the two of you about is a story focused on search and Amazon set to compete a bit more convincingly with Google in the search business over the coming 12 to 18 months. This was a piece, it was a report and an article associated with it released by eMarketer. I think we talked a couple of months ago about the predicted growth in Amazon's search business and then their advertising business. And what's interesting about this is that Amazon's sort of growth in their search business is really taking off, and they're expected to move a good number of percentage points over the coming 12 to 18 months. However, it's still tiny in comparison to Google's share of the search market. So the report says Google's huge 73% market share is due to reduce down to about 70% over the coming 18 months, and Amazon's going to be picking up a significant proportion of that growth and hold about 15% of the search market by 2021. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this. What I'm particularly interested in is how does that feel for Google? Because I know, 70% is still a huge amount, But that 3% difference between 73% and 70%, how much does that change their business, and where do they start to look to for replacement in that revenue and in that kind of hold? And I think we've had discussions before about whether Google cares more about their advertising business than their search business, or the other way around. So this is what this article kind of makes me think. And I'm also interested in hearing your view on Amazon search in general. You know, how has it got to that point? Is it definitely going to, you know, continue to be the front runner? Are we going to see it really start to sort of snap at the heels of Google in sort of another 5 to 10 years' time? How's this going to unfold?
Yeah.
James?
One of your questions, how would Google feel about this? Irritated, I'd imagine. You know, it's an understatement to say their business is diversified, but, you know, they're still predominantly a search business. That's their bread and butter. I think it's really interesting how Amazon have started to take a chunk of that search business. And what I'm really intrigued by is whether it's by design or whether it's happy accident.
Yeah.
Because it's consumer behavior. You know, Amazon has become the largest retailer on the planet. Consumers go there to start their search for products of any stripe, or categories of any stripe. They don't start on Google. You know, 10 years ago, if I wanted to buy a navy sweater, Google, or online, Google, navy sweaters. You know, now, Amazon, navy sweaters. You know, for any product, that's where the search starts. So my assumption would be that's what's
driving the
growth of Amazon's search. And I don't know how Google can counter that, because while Google Shopping is undeniably successful, it's not as successful on anywhere near the same scale as Amazon's. And that's a trend that's not going to be reversed. So the more people are starting their shopping journey on Amazon, the more of that search revenue is going to be cannibalized from Google.
Mm. Lindsay?
I mean, I agree with that. I mean, Google Shopping still requires you as a retailer to have product feeds that Google can scrape. And many still don't do that, largely because they don't want Google to actually have access to that, because they worry about what Google will do with it. With Amazon, almost everyone sells their products on Amazon. We were talking about Nike earlier selling their products on Amazon, so almost everything's there. But Amazon's taking a large chunk of the search business, but it's also limited in how much of a chunk. Oh, James just knocking the phone off the hook there.
Hold all my calls.
Try not to trash the studio, James.
You could just refrain from hitting things up.
That would be great.
Very much.
Lost my train of thought now. How dare you? Unbelievable. So
you were talking about Nike.
Yeah. So Amazon's share of the search business will only ever be a portion of Google's, because what Amazon is able to cater towards is only a portion of what Google caters towards.
Yeah.
So Amazon's competing against Google Shopping, basically, not against Google as entirety as a search engine, because I can't search for flights on Amazon.
Yeah.
I can't search for insurance on Amazon. I can't, maybe one day.
Yet.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. It's the days where if I wanted to go and find insurance, I would go to an aggregator, or I'd go to Direct Line or More Than or whatever else. And I wouldn't be able to see those results directly in the Google search and results page, which I now can. So Google have had to diversify to try and keep people on Google as much as possible, because the more people keep people on Google, the more revenue they get. Amazon will be wise to that as well. So what else will Amazon try and get into to try and make sure that Amazon is the one port of call? And I'd also question kind of what role Alexa plays in that as well, because that is also going to be where search queries are certainly going up. How Amazon can monetize that yet, and how advertisers can make use of that from a monetary perspective, is still questionable. There's still a lot of testing and learning going on as to, okay, well, if I can work out how Alexa delivers search results, can I do something to get my brand appearing higher up? But that, I think, will be the next thing. But then Google obviously have Google Home. Apple has the weird pod thing, whatever it's called. So there'll be
HomePod.
HomePod. That's
really
the one.
Expensive HomePod, I think, is the official title.
Oh, really?
Apple
yeah.
has the really expensive HomePod in its armory. Yeah, so I think that will also be another interesting play, but we're still quite nascent on the audio, the kind of smart speaker side of things.
Yeah. It sort of brings us back to consumer behaviour again, though, right? Because firstly, definitely consumer behaviour on an audio piece. I think we're still not there yet. I always think, because, you know, I think, you know, again, what was the phrase you used earlier, James? A sample size of one. I kind of think my own habits, I'm never an early adopter, but I'm never the last person to get on the bandwagon either. And I think audio search for me, and I've got Alexa via my Sonos at home, it's still just not right. It just doesn't work. It's annoying. The speaker comes on when I don't want it to come on. It asks me things when I'm not interested.
Big then privacy issues.
Yeah, get creeped out by it, so I've turned it off. And
they're still buggy, and also they aren't very intelligent.
No,
they're not actually intelligent.
That feels far away.
They learn
real
pre-phrases, and they're not intelligent enough yet to be able to do anything for themselves.
Yeah.
But they will be.
It does feel far away, but it is where I think the battle for the future of search lies is with voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not there yet. And I think what's really interesting when we're talking about Amazon starting to eat into Google's market share is Amazon have the march on voice in the home.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Alexa has almost become the default for that. Mm. I know there's Google's Home Pod, no, wasn't that? That's Apple.
No, that's Apple's.
No, it's not Nest.
I thought it was Google Home.
They did buy Nest.
Is it Google?
No,
Home?
Google.
But again, here we go. We don't know what it
exactly
is.
Exactly.
And yet, we know what Alexa
clearly
is.
None of us,
you know,
have.
And then also Facebook with Facebook.
Google
is
Home.
Google Home.
Yeah.
Is it Facebook Portal?
Yeah.
Which is the new thing that's
the
about to come
video,
out.
The creepy video. It's powered by Alexa, though, isn't it? That one.
Is that powered
yeah,
by Alexa?
I think
okay.
So
that's where the battle lies. I mean, if you think about, I've always been interested in the reduction of friction in search. You know, which is why I always thought image recognition search would be something really interesting. You know, companies like Blipper, which, you know,
yeah,
died a death.
Unfortunately died.
But, you know, the notion that to search for something, you have to A, know what it is, and B, type it.
Mm.
And then a step on from that, you're reducing friction by saying, well, I don't have to type it anymore. I can just say it.
Mm.
And then a step off from that is I don't even have to know what it is. I can just point a camera at it and it knows what it is and says, right, search for that. But, you know, I think image search is maybe a little bit too far on the horizon. Mm. Voice search is undeniably the future, and Amazon have a march on that, but it's not just in the home as well, it's in the car.
Yeah.
And then in the car, it's invariably comes via your mobile phone. So therefore it's either through Siri if you use Apple CarPlay or whatever Android's voice assistant is when you use Android's connected car.
Bixby.
Mm. No, I thought Bixby was
oh, is it not?
I thought Bixby was Samsung's.
Oh, maybe.
So again, confusion.
Yeah,
Samsung, so
Samsung,
Android devices,
most
device
Android
manufacturer
users in this country are Samsung. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think Bixby is Samsung.
I think
don't
you're
quote
right
me on that.
No,
I say
I think
being
right
recorded.
we'll just not only quote you on it, we'll record you.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is a car crash.
Yeah. Oh dear! I knew it was wrong to start drinking this evening.
I think that's the best preparation for a Mad Tech podcast. Lindsay, you okay? I know. I feel like we're choking
the
cough there.
This is getting worse and worse
exactly
now.
Exactly.
The 10-car pile up now.
Please don't die in the middle of the Mad Tech podcast. But it is really interesting to see how this is changing search habits, right? Because Google have frankly had it easy for a long time. And actually, I feel like search is fundamentally changing at the moment. So it's to do with consumer awareness, but also consumer habits driven by competitors and other things that are available. I don't know about you guys, but these days when I do type something into the Google search bar, I feel like it used to be just the first couple of results were, advertisements, but now I feel like the entire page
yeah
is. And I'm thinking to myself, what are you actually showing me? Are you showing me people that are paying for these search results, or are you genuinely showing me a range of potential options? And so I find myself doing all sorts of other
yeah
things to circumnavigate it. I'm going to Amazon, I'm going to other marketplace platforms depending on what it is I'm looking for or shopping for. I'm going to, if it's about information and news, I'm going directly to news sites or other news aggregation platforms to find out that information, which for me at the moment feels really complicated. But I know it's driven by the fact that I'm not satisfied with Google search
yeah
anymore. I feel it's a different product.
They move the side results,
yes,
the side ads. So you used to have two or three at the top, then maybe six or seven down the side. They then shifted them down to the bottom. So you've now got kind of the search results pages flanked by ads, but it does make it you're having to scroll more and more before you get to an organic search listing.
Yeah,
that for some people be very frustrating.
Which isn't an improved user experience.
No. Not at all. It's a worse user experience, hands down.
But given all the testing that Google does on the SERP, the search and results page, I'm amazed that that is what they've netted out at as being a success.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because it drives me insane.
Yeah,
and I started my media career in search, so I have a
bit of
affinity
an
to
understanding.
Search,
yeah.
I'm just like, well, what the hell's that for?
Mm.
Do you mind if we take a little bit of a tangent? I was just
go on
tangent away.
Just really interested in going back to the home voice assistants and the privacy thing, which is obviously a huge thing. How much awareness do you think there is from people using these things in the home about how much of their data is being shared?
In general, I would say very little, but it's increasing. And, and the reason I say increasing is because it's something that's being so heavily talked about in the media, privacy, data privacy in general. And so then I think that is flaring some conversations around what tools you use in general and in the home that might actually be using your data. But I think it's really low.
I think that in a year's time, there'll be more awareness by the general person as to what how their voice data is being used on smart speakers versus how their online data is being used when they use their phone or their laptop.
Yeah.
Because that still is so, people just don't even think or realise.
It's extremely opaque. People don't know. But that will only, I reckon we'll only achieve that though, Lindsay, if someone clearly articulates the difference between the two and what's happening with your voice search activity and what happens with what you do online. Because there's still some people, so I find it easier to explain these days. Some friends that, you know, have no idea about digital advertising or the world of advertising will say, how is it that, you know, my husband was looking for something online and then it came up on my iPad. And so I'll talk to them about cross-device targeting in a household context. And they understand I no longer have to go into detail about it. They go, oh, right, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So it's not that they don't get how that can happen. It's that they're still just not aware that it's happening at all.
Yeah.
But it's only through people telling, through someone telling them that they'll get that awareness.
This is the thing, I think there's more scaremongering with voice. But there's not enough scaremongering with how I'm
searching. Because it's listening to
you. Exactly. That's the thing, isn't it? That's because what I think people are more terrified about.
With data online and targeting, you know, the quid pro quo, which I'm not sure is entirely apparent to everyone, is, you know, data is used to serve ads that are relevant to you. And if ads are more relevant to you, they're surely going to be of more value to you. And advertising is what means the internet doesn't disappear behind a paywall. So, you know, it's sort of, there's lots of moving parts here, isn't it? Everyone's got a, sort of a an investment in it. But I do think it's a step further having something in your home that is listening.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because it's connected to so many other things, it's not just about advertising and keeping the internet free. It's about surveillance, unfortunately, because we know that those are exactly the tools that will be used in a completely other context, in a political surveillance context where those tools are needed. But, you know, should we all be subjected to that? So that's where I think that debate and that conversation is going to start going.
But then strangely, I don't have a a smart speaker in the home. But yeah, I use Siri, and when that's connected in my car, I use its Apple CarPlay and I use voice commands. I'm totally happy doing that. But yeah, I don't feel comfortable doing it in the home. I have no idea why.
Maybe it's, you know, when you shout at the cat or the dog, you don't want anyone to know.
It's more about when I'm getting shouted at.
Versus singing in the car, maybe.
That's it. Yeah, exactly.
I don't mind Siri listening to my singing.
No.
We mind listening to your singing, though, sometimes.
Sorry about that.
Lindsay's a big singer in the office, listeners.
Yeah.
You'll be pleased to know. We might get you to do a tune on the Christmas special.
You've got a microphone in front of you.
I was singing Sound of Music and yodeling, so
she was earlier on.
Everybody wants to kill me today.
That's how that started. Anyway, well, we've already kind of started to go there, but James, let's use the second part of the podcast to chat a little bit about what you're working on at M&C Saatchi Performance, some of the stuff that you're working on with brands, and in particular, in prep for this, we started talking about the world of brands connecting directly with consumers. So maybe you can just kick off with talking a bit about what you're working on at the moment and your perspective on the world of DTC businesses.
Yeah, so I mean, as we talked about briefly before, I think, you know, direct to consumer is a really interesting space, and I think there's a number of different ways you can frame it. You know, when we talk about direct to consumer brands, we're talking about these disruptor brands that have emerged in the last 10 years or so. You know, whether it be mattress companies like Eve Sleep or Simba, whether it be razors like Dollar Shave Club and Harry's, and you know, they've undeniably gained massive market share in a short space of time for a number of reasons, you know, like reduced friction in the supply chain and the being able to engage directly with consumers and the sort of what they know about their customers being far in excess of what their traditional competitors know. You know, what Gillette knows about their customers buying a razor in Boots versus what Dollar Shave Club know about their consumers is enormous. I mean, yes, Gillette can buy data, but it's not the same. You know, so these brands are fascinating. They've been able to, I mean, I think Gillette took about 15% of, sorry, Dollar Shave Club took about 15% of Gillette's market share in the US. I mean, it's enormous.
It's quite incredible.
And these brands are really sophisticated performance marketers. And we work with a number of them, but also a number of them do it themselves. You know, so in housing is a big challenge for us, and there's a number of conversations we're constantly having with different brands in that space about why we as an agency can add value above what they do themselves. And I can speak about that in a bit. The other thing that's really interesting, though, is what we term D2C being applied to more traditional brands who, you know, weren't born in the digital economy, you know, legacy brands that are getting disrupted by these new direct consumer brands. They still have a similar customer journey. You know, they will still sell products online. They'll still need to reach consumers and drive them to convert or take an action on a website or something like that. And in actual fact, the user journey between something like an Eve Sleep and one of our clients, EDF Energy, is the same. We're looking to engage with consumers. We're looking to drive them through the funnel. We're looking to drive them to a owned portal to convert. But yet, the more traditional brands don't necessarily take a performance-first approach to reaching their audience. Mm. And I think what's really interesting about that type of brand is what we often refer to as the squeezed middle. You know, and if you take a category like energy, you know, you've got at the top of the category, you've got British Gas, and frankly, they just outspend everyone. Mm. And then at the other end, you've got disruptor brands like Bulb and green energy providers.
Yeah.
And in the middle, you've got companies like EDF and Npower and other established energy companies. And they're sort of getting attacked from both sides. And this applies to, I think, every category where brands like this exist, is there's an opportunity for them to start doing things differently.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've been working with EDF now about 18 months, 2 years. In the first 14 to 16 months of working with them, they didn't run any TV. And they invested more money in direct digital sales through performance marketing. And during that time, their brand score was unaffected, but their digital sales went up.
Yeah, right.
Interesting.
And this is a model we think is the right thing to do for a number of hundreds and hundreds of brands that exist in that space.
Yeah.
Who should apply the same sort of performance marketing tactics that these direct-to-consumer brands have used to such great effect to scale so rapidly, to try and, you know, break the chains a little bit from what might be more traditional brand-led TV, out-of-home campaign activity to more sort of performance-oriented marketing that we can measure and track and optimise.
But they are almost doing, they're now in a position where they're going to be doing the reverse of what a lot of these DTC brands are doing, because a lot of the big DTC brands that built massive scale by advertising and getting, like, acquiring all their customers on the likes of Facebook, Instagram and Google, and now going, we want to build a brand now. We want people to know who we are. So they're
looking
into
more
TV
traditional channels.
Trust.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is. But EDF already have that, for example.
The established brands have
that. So
they're
going, we don't need to do that. We can go the other way.
Now we need to do the more nimble. Yeah. And, you know, people are being asked to be more accountable for, you know, with their budgets. You know, it's you know, I'm disappointed to say, not, you know, long lunches and expensive taxi rides
times
out to clients
changed.
in Slough, you know, and leaving the meter running. It's you know, it's people are being asked to be more accountable with their budgets, and performance marketing, obviously, or performance media affords you the ability to do that. But you're right about the, and it's interesting when you see Uber advertising, you see Facebook advertising, but that for me is a trust thing.
Yeah, we're talking about Airbnb earlier as well. Yeah, absolutely. You think they do have trust already, yeah, but actually the fact they're now putting themselves on TV after so many years
sort of validates you.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It does in a way. And going back to, we perhaps did a little bit of TV bashing earlier, but that is a key component of TV, isn't it? It's just that trust. You see it on your television, if indeed you're watching television, and you immediately trust them a bit more.
So it's almost like equipping those more traditional brands that are in that kind of middle squeezed layer that you're talking about, equipping them with some of the sort of agility, I suppose, of the kind of challenger mindset, if you like. How did you sort of arrive at that conversation with EDF? Was it an easy thing to convince them of? What was that sort of journey like?
I think it was, you know, we were working with a really sort of brave and ambitious marketing team who, you know, accepted they needed to change is not the right, but, you know, needed to try new things. So that,
well, I guess they started working with you. And first and foremost, you said it yourself, we're a performance agency.
We are
so
a
obviously
performance
them
agency.
Making that choice to come and work with yes. you is a big statement of intent. Yes.
Exactly.
And we're a performance agency with a heritage in mobile. You know, we changed our name to MSC Saatchi Performance last year to reflect what we do more broadly across the entire digital spectrum. When we started working with EDF Energy, we were called MSC Saatchi Mobile. Yeah. So this is a household brand. One of the big six energy providers in the UK are working with a mobile performance agency to buy their digital. Incredibly brave. But it's
sorry to cut across, but so that's really interesting, because I'm always interested in how this happens within big organisations and more traditional organisations, because it must require a kind of organisational change or change in mindset, as it were. So like Lindsay said, or like you said, perhaps it's an ambitious marketing team. Had they already decided internally, right, this is it, we need to go after more performance advertising, or do you know anything about what that journey was like for them?
Not necessarily, no. I think, as I mentioned earlier, only that there was, you know, there was an opportunity to look at trying new things.
Yeah,
you know, that's what it ultimately was driven by, and then we had to demonstrate that, you know, that we could help them do that in some senses.
Yeah, so
that just went weirdly quiet. Yeah, silent.
I liked it though. Stop talking. Oh, you're done? Okay. Pregnant pause.
No, I was thinking about something else when you asked me that question. It is related to what we're doing here. It's not something else entirely. But I was just thinking, what's really interesting about that, when we're chatting to brands that exist, and when we're working with brands that exist in the digital economy, those traditional D2C brands, we're dealing with performance marketers. We're dealing with people with growth in their job title, with heads of UA. You know, these people are interested in numbers and conversions and KPIs and CPAs and, you know, incrementality and attribution and all this stuff. When we're talking to the more traditional brands, we're talking to marketing directors and CMOs, and their mindset is a little bit different. And it's really interesting we work with a really ambitious marketing team at EDF Energy, but a lot of the time it's interesting taking people along that journey. You know, performance marketing isn't just search. It's not just about hoovering up that lower funnel people are about to convert. There's so much you can do throughout the funnel, as I mentioned earlier, about measuring what we might term brand activity on digital in the upper funnel, and migrating people through the funnel and tracking and measuring and optimizing everything as we go through, as we're driving people through towards conversion. That's a journey that I think more traditional marketers need to adopt.
And that's what's interesting, is that, like you said, you are talking to marketing directors within those organisations. And so that marketing role itself is, I suppose, changing, or the perspective of that marketer is changing a little bit. And presumably they're drawn to the notion of more customer data, possibly, you know, more understanding of the ways in which anything that they're doing from a marketing perspective within the organisation, whether that's brand or whether that's performance campaigns, how is that actually resonating with the customers? It's much more of a holistic approach. And it's interesting that, you know, we sort of typify what you're describing that you're doing for them there as performance, and perhaps something that's a little more second nature to those challenger digitally native brands. But why shouldn't, you know, big traditional brands be comfortable with that? It's a legitimate part of the marketing, of marketing activity. And it's really interesting to see that that's being led in those more traditional brands from a marketer, from a CMO or a marketing director.
And measurability, accountability, you know, it's being able to track the efficacy of every penny I've spent.
That
goes a long way these days. And I know we were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, digital budgets are up, and that's great. But I still firmly believe that the trend I've noticed over the last 10 years, and probably since, you know, the financial crash, what was it, 2008, you know, budgets are more squeezed.
Absolutely. Everybody's got to prove value.
You're being asked to do more with less, you know, and performance marketing is a really, really good way of doing that, because you are accounting for every single penny you spend. And quite frankly, we live and die by that. If we don't perform, we're not doing our job, you're done. We're given targets to hit. We work with clients on what, you know, business outcomes are, on these really sort of tangible business change metrics, whether it be conversions or sales or subscriptions or whatever it might be. We work towards a target CPA for that. If we're not hitting it, we're not performing.
Fantastic. We've actually run out of time, I'm sorry to say. That was a very enjoyable conversation.
It was.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, James, for joining us in the office. Thank you, Lindsay. I think we're all going to go and probably look at some trainers online now.
Absolutely. Can't wait.
Absolutely. And change our energy provider.
Oh, yes, of course.
Hello, EDF.
Thank you very much.
And that was this week's MadTech Podcast.